Thibodeau's watching the news one night, and the announcer says, "Recent studies have indicated 75% of all accidents occur within a mile of your house." So he moved. The new year. Everybody makes New Year's resolutions. Oh, I don't. I gave up the sham years ago. And you know that there's no concept of a New Year's resolution in the Bible. In fact, there's the opposite concept. See, the concept behind a New Year's resolution is I'm going to do better. I'm going to try harder. The theme of the Bible is that will make it worse. And the Bible never addresses remodeling issues. And the best place to learn how God wants us, to deal with 2008 coming up is the story of Israel. Israel was held bondage in Egypt. And to help them, God did not improve Egypt. He led them out into a new land, Canaan. And that's what we find in the book of Joshua. Let me review quickly to put Joshua in the context of biblical history. The movement of the Bible begins Genesis chapter 11. Abraham was over in the city of Ur. God called Abram and said, "Go to this new land I have for you." Again, remember, he did not improve Ur. He took Abraham out of Ur and brought him to Canaan. And it was a beautiful land, Canaan. And in Canaan, Abraham had a son, Isaac. Isaac had a son, Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. Those 12 sons became the tribes of Israel, the nation of Israel, which was born in Canaan. But the nation became a great nation in Egypt because one of Jacob's sons, Joseph, went to Egypt. You'll recall, not under his own will, but he went to Egypt and he became prime minister over Egypt, and he brought his whole family down. 70 people came down. And in Egypt, that group of 70 became a nation of 3 million people. Genesis closes with Israel prospering in the land of Egypt. That curtain closes, curtain of Exodus rises, and we got a different scene entirely. After 400 years, they're in bondage. So at that time in history, God raises up Moses. And he said, "Moses, you're going to be my agent to deliver the nation of Israel out of Egypt and take them to Canaan." And from the very beginning, God described Canaan in two ways. It's a land of abundance and a land of rest. And that's very important we understand, because there's a Canaan life available for all of us. And it's abundance and rest. Exodus 3:8, God tells Moses, "I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and take them to Canaan." And watch this pattern. It's always the same two concepts of Canaan, abundance and rest. And to bring them up from that land, Egypt, to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, abundance and rest. Joshua 1:13, Joshua said, "Remember the Lord which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, 'The Lord your God gives you rest and will rest and will give you this land.'" Over and over in the Bible, when Canaan is described, it's abundance and rest. Deuteronomy 33:28. Here's a picture of Israel as it will be for them in Canaan. So Israel dwells in security in the land of grain and new wine. By the way, we're Baptists. That's grape juice. His heavens also drop down dew. See, what a picture of abundance. And you know what? It's not. I love this picture. It's not where you have a downpour and then drought. Downpour, drought. He said, no, every day a little gentle rain comes down. And you don't have to hope it'll rain. Leviticus 4 through 7. "I will give you rains in their season," he's describing Canaan, "so that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Indeed, your threshing will last for you until grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until sowing time." He's saying 12 months of the whole year you're either harvesting grain or fruit. There's no lag time. "You will thus eat your food to the full." There's abundance, see? But remember, it's also rest. "And you will live securely in your land. I will grant you peace in the land, so you may lie down with no one making you tremble. I will eliminate harmful beasts from the land, and no sword will pass through your land." So God says, "I'm going to deliver you out of Egyptian bondage." See, again, I'm not going to improve Egypt. I'm going to take you to a new land, Canaan. abundance and rest. And again, we want to remember that because it's all I just read to you is a picture of the physical life in Canaan. But it's a picture of the spiritual life available to us. Abundance and rest. So they go out of Egypt. They go through the Red Sea. They go down to Mount Sinai. Then they leave Mount Sinai and they head towards Canaan. To get to Canaan, they have to go through the wilderness. It should have been a very short trip to the wilderness. A few weeks later, in fact, they're at the border of Canaan to a place called Kadesh Barnea. At that place, 12 spies go in and they roam around through the land. And they come back with what they have found. Numbers 13:23. Then they, that's the 12 spies, they came to the valley of Eshcol, and from there they cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two men with some of the pomegranates and the figs. If you saw somebody coming out of Walmart with a pole of grapes on it, wouldn't you stop and ask them what they were doing? Well, that picture of all the grapes and the pomegranates and figs, that's a picture of the abundance of Canaan. So all 12 of the spies come back and they say, it certainly is, as advertised, it certainly is a land of abundance. There's no question. All 12 said that. Numbers 13:27. Thus they told him and said, we went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. All 12 said that. But there's a strong difference of opinion because 10 of them are, what's a nice word? Chicken. Cowards. 13:28. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are very strong. They're probably talking like little whiny boys. And the cities are all fortified and large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Those were the giants. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. That's pretty kind of funny. He said, we looked at them, we looked like grasshoppers. When they looked at us, they confirmed it. Yep. So you see, the 10 say, there is great abundance. But we're afraid. We recommend we don't go in. Now the other two say, let's go in. Numbers 13:30. Caleb, we also know from the context Joshua's with him, quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. See, the 10 had remembered. Remember, Canaan was two things, abundance and rest. The 10 wimps remembered the abundance. They forgot the rest. The 2 remembered the abundance. They remembered the rest. They said, wait, God did not only promise abundance. He promised us rest. Therefore, He must be going to take care of those giants if He promised us rest. Because what kind of a place would it be if it was a land of abundance and constant fighting? That wouldn't sound good. He said, it's abundance and rest. So they said, well, let's go in. Majority ruled. They didn't go in. They go back to the wilderness. And for 40 years, they wander in like a big oval. For 40 years, they go up north just to the edge of Canaan, just where they can peek in, maybe put one foot over, say, nay, nay, boo, boo, I went to Canaan. Then they go back to the wilderness. For 40 years, they do that. 40 years. And for 40 years, they're grumbling and complaining the whole time. God kept sending them miraculous food. I mean, if he couldn't find them natural food, He sent food down from heaven. Did they care? No, they grumbled, complained the whole time. Secondly, the whole time, those 40 years, they kept looking back to Egypt. Longingly to Egypt. They forgot it was a land of bondage. But there's, you know what the problem was? They were emotionally attached to Egypt. The whole 40 years. Now, at the end of 40 years, every unbeliever in that group had died. So now it's time to go back to Canaan. So now they go up to the east of the Dead Sea, come north of the Dead Sea, and it's time to go in. As they go in, it's time for a change of leadership. Moses, who's led them this far, cannot take them into Canaan. And next week I'll tell you why. So Moses said, well, if I can't lead them in, who's to lead them in? God says, it's Joshua. So Joshua is the one who will lead them into Canaan. Abundance and rest. Now we've seen three geographical areas, haven't we? Egypt, the wilderness, and Canaan. And those three geographical areas correspond to three different spiritual conditions. I'm going to review from last week fairly quickly. Egypt is a picture of the world. So Egyptians are a picture of unbelievers. Now, there are two things typical of unbelievers. One, unbelievers are dominated by flesh. Their flesh. Now, it does not mean that they are necessarily horribly evil. Flesh has a wide variety of manifestations. The one thing constant about flesh is that flesh drives a person to get his needs met in the world. So, the unbeliever is tied to the world. In fact, well, there are three things about the unbeliever in the world. Remember, not very good. NVG. The unbeliever gets his needs met in the world, he gets his values from the world, and he gets his goals from the world. So the unbeliever is tied to the flesh. And secondly, the unbeliever is dominated by Satan. So back to our story, Egypt represents the world, and Pharaoh represents Satan, who has dominion over the world. So the unbeliever is dominated by Satan. Now once again, that does not mean that everybody is always horribly evil. When Satan dominates somebody, that does not mean he becomes an open Satan worshiper. Doesn't mean he becomes horribly evil. In fact, Satan would prefer that people he dominates do not become evil. You know why? That makes him look bad. See, what Satan does to keep the unbeliever under his control is this. Satan takes advantage of the fact that by nature, an unbeliever is tied to the world. See, without Satan, an unbeliever automatically, by nature, looks to the world to get his needs met. So you see what Satan does? It's very simple. To keep that system going, what Satan does is present the world as a good place for people to get their needs met. Unfortunately, much of Christianity today is trying to improve the world. You know what? You're going counter to God. It doesn't mean Christians cannot be involved in issues involving pollution and environment. It doesn't mean that at all. In fact, I wish more Christians would. But, basically, God is not redesigning the world. And again, God did not improve Egypt. He took them out of Egypt. So you see, what Satan does is present the world a good place for people to get their needs met, so to reinforce the tie of the unbeliever to the world and to reinforce his dominion over them. So Egypt is the world, Egyptians are unbelievers, and Satan is a picture of Pharaoh who keeps people under his bondage. Therefore, when Israel was in Egypt before they were taken out, they were a picture of somebody who had not yet been saved. Right? There's somebody who will be saved, but at that point they're still unsaved. But God raised the believers out. He took them out of Egypt through the Exodus. He brought them out of Egypt, meaning he brought them out of the world. He brought them out of Pharaoh, meaning he brought them out from the dominion of Satan. Therefore, whenever we look at the Exodus, the parting of the waters of the Red Sea in the Bible, that's always a picture of our salvation. Because before they were taken out of Egypt, in fact, the only ones who were led out of Egypt were the ones who had taken the blood of the Lamb and put it on their doorpost in the shape of a cross. Then they come out of Egypt and they pass through the Red Sea. That's a picture of our being baptized into Jesus, the passing through the Red Sea. So the Israelites come out of Egypt, they go into the wilderness. And in the wilderness, as we've seen, the whole time they're looking back to Egypt. They're out of Egypt physically, but they're emotionally still tied to Egypt. Now that corresponds to something. That wilderness life of Israel corresponds to the wilderness life many Christians live. In fact, I'm very tempted to say, no, I'll just say it. I think most Christians live in the wilderness. What is wilderness life? Wilderness life is this. They are Christians. They are certainly saved. Been brought out of Egypt. But wilderness life is being saved, but still being attached to the world. Still looking to the world to get our needs met. That's why I said before, I think most Christians are really not much different from moral unbelievers. Can someone tell me the big difference between moral unbelievers and Christians? I think there's not much. Because you know why? We're living in the wilderness. The unbelievers attached to the world, we're attached to the world. And the reason it's hard to tell the difference between Christians and moral unbelievers is not because we're equally bad, it's because we're equally good. Now here are some clues to know if we're living in wilderness life. Struggle. Self-effort. Sometimes, and by the way, the problem with self-effort is sometimes it'll work out, sometimes it won't. Disappointments. Wilderness life means our emotions are tied to the world. Our emotions are okay if things are going well, they're bad if they're not. That's wilderness life. Now probably we're very much like Israel. Probably we don't spend our whole life in the wilderness as Christians. We probably spend most of our time wandering around the wilderness and occasionally setting foot, getting a little peek in, one little step into Canaan, and then you go back to the wilderness. Well, so those three areas, Egypt is the world, the wilderness is a place where people are saved, but still attached to the world. And then there's Canaan life. And Canaan life is a life, remember, it's not heaven. We have all these songs on Jordan, stormy banks I stand, looking across to Canaan as if it's heaven. No, Canaan is the life we can have right now. It's available to us. Now, Canaan life is so different from the life we live now. It's not an improved version. And again, let me remind you, God did not improve Egypt to give them a better life. He took them to a new place. He's like Thibodeau. He said the accidents occur within a mile of your house, so he moved. He didn't try to improve his neighborhood. He moved. And you see, Canaan life, we tend to think it's just an improved version of the life I have now. No, it's a completely new way of living. He doesn't clean up our lives now. He sends us to a new place to live. That's Canaan life. Now, maybe the best way... So we had a whole generation of people who sort of knew about this Canaan life and had seen it from a distance, maybe set foot, but never lived it. So you had a whole generation of Israelites who didn't have abundance and they didn't have rest. And that's what's available for us. It's abundance and it's rest. Actually, you know, the two are tied together. The concept of abundance and the concept of rest. Because, see, here's how they're connected. Because God has promised us to take care of our needs, then we can rest. Now, you know why we don't rest? One reason we don't rest is that we don't really believe He'll supply our needs. We think our needs come from our work. Now, here's the problem with that thinking. We look to the world to get our needs met. The world's not a solid place. There's nothing substantial in the world. There's no guarantees in the world. We can do our work exactly right. We can plan exactly right. And how much control do we have out there? Approximately zero. So we think that our abundance comes from how hard we work. No, that means we'll never rest. If we literally believe He'll take care of our needs, then we'll rest. That's Canaan. See, abundance and rest, they're tied together. In fact, before we go into Canaan, I'd like to linger just a moment today on this whole concept of rest. Or we'll never understand the book of Joshua. And that means 2008 will be just like 2007 was. This Canaan life, abundance and rest, is a wonderful life. It's available to tell us. But you see, for most of us, I believe we're like Israel. We kind of circle around it and kind of look up there and we're kind of aware there's a better life, but we don't step in there. And that's why I love the verse we saw last week, Hebrews 4:9. There remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. I love that wording. He doesn't say they have one. He says it remains. Think of all your Christmas presents opened except one. There's still one under the tree not open. It's still remaining there. So he says it still remains. It's available for you. It's available for you. Now, isn't it odd? We don't enter into rest. Now, you would think we would want to enter into rest. In fact, I think the reason that we don't enter into rest and abundance, Canaan life, I think it's not because we don't want to rest. I think it's because we don't understand what that means. Isn't that the issue? We hear Canaan life of rest, and we don't, again, it's not that we don't want it, we don't know what that means. You know why? It's another one of those biblical truths that it's not intuitive. See, what is intuitive, see if you agree with this. What's intuitive to me is that rest means not doing anything. To me, in my world, I think you work or you rest. And you work responsibly to get what you need, or you rest, you don't do anything, and that's bad. That's intuitive to me. Now, Canaan life is a life of rest, but it's not that kind of rest. You ready for... I'm going to warn you, you're going to have many paradoxes today. Canaan life is active rest. So you see, paradoxically, we have to learn how to rest. And here's another verse I love from Hebrews. Hebrews 4:11. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest. Don't you love that verse? Let us be diligent to enter that rest. Because he's saying it's going to be a struggle.